they cost less money, but they are reimbursed more by the hospitals than a natural spontaneous vaginal birth. Vaginal birth takes a long time. The regular spontaneous birth is a process that takes a long time. It's okay, it's healthy, it's the way our bodies were built. If we can go through that process of natural birth, it costs more, and hospitals don't necessarily want to pay for it. But I think in general, we really need to think about in this country how we're birthing. Is it really about hurrying up and get that baby out? Or is it about allowing a woman's body to do what it's supposed to do, that she can, so that she can bring forth this baby in the time that she's supposed to be doing it, in the safest way possible?
Paula Azelt, in the film, you have expectant mom Felicia Ellis from Tulsa, Oklahoma, saying a black woman having a baby is like a black man at a traffic stop with police. In Oklahoma, the maternal mortality rate, black maternal mortality rate, is double the national average. Talk about this in the Momnibus bill in Congress.
Yeah.
And we have 30 seconds.
Okay, so the Momnibus bill, set of bills in Congress, would be the largest investment in maternal health, specifically black maternal health, in this country. It would improve access to midwives, as we spoke about before, increase the complete perinatal workforce, create more culturally congruent care. So that's allowing more black midwives into the space and more educational trainings. It would extend postpartum coverage throughout the country. Right now, Medicaid in some states only cover up to 6 weeks, and we know that women can die up to 1 year postpartum. So that collection of bills would do a tremendous amount to cut down this mortality rate and improve birthing for all American women.
Paula Izelt and Tanya Lewis-Lay, a fantastic film, co-directors of the new documentary Aftershock, now streaming on Hulu. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Every single person since SB8 has been a law has needed to travel out of state. Every single person that's reached our line.
We've been clinging on to Roe versus Wade and the protection that it offered. And it feels as though that protection is being taken away from us. So it feels as though this is a moment of survival. And I think any moments of survival can be very scary.
What did abortion access look like in America when Roe was the law of the land? Tune into KBOO's Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I investigate this question as I take you through the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe. That's Roe on the Rocks, airing Thursdays at 9 a.m. You don't want to miss it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, extreme heat hits the Portland metro area this week, another large wildfire in California threatens Yosemite National Park, and in international news, Pope Francis visits Canada to deliver an apology to Indigenous people impacted by residential schools. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 25th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. 85 million Americans are under excessive heat warnings this week, and the Pacific Northwest is joining that count. Both the Greater Portland area and the Greater Vancouver area have excessive heat warnings from the National Weather Service this week. The warning started Monday at noon and runs through Thursday at 9 p.m. Temperatures will be in the high 90s and low 100s, with the highest temperatures expected on Tuesday and Wednesday. Evening temperatures are forecasted to only drop to between 65 and 70 degrees, which presents little relief for residents who don't have air conditioning. People can be at higher risk of heat-related illnesses if they work or spend time outside at this time. Officials recommend residents drink lots of water and minimize their time outside, as well as consider rescheduling any outdoor activities or work they have planned. Last year's heat dome in June 2021 caused 69 confirmed deaths in Multnomah County alone. 78% were older than 60, and 71% of those that died lived alone. County officials stressed in a press release that it's a critical time to check on friends and neighbors to be sure they're prepared for the heat. Cooling shelters are open in Multnomah County. Libraries will be open until 8 p.m. Additionally, the county has an interactive map of all cooling sites across the county, both indoor and outdoor. It's online at the site tinyurl.com/coolplacesmultco. Residents can ride TriMet to a cooling center for free so long as they tell the driver that's where they're going. People can also seek out a ride to a cooling center by calling 211. Metro area counties have their own plans and cooling centers that can be found on their respective websites. Multnomah and Washington counties have also instituted outdoor burn bans starting Monday. That means campfires, fire pits, yard debris, and agricultural burning are prohibited. Outdoor barbecuing is still okay, but residents are cautioned to dispose of hot briquettes carefully. Officials worry that with high temperatures and no rain, a small burn could get out of control fast. All but 10 of those who lost their lives in the heat dome last year didn't have air conditioning, something Multnomah County worked to remedy. It's purchased 180 AC units to install for free for residents, but as of Saturday, only 92 of those had been installed. Those AC units are free to clients of the city's Aging, Disability, and Veteran Services, as well as the Developmental Disability Division offices. For those without AC, officials recommend sleeping with their windows open and setting alarms to make sure they let in cooler air in the evening and shut their windows by the time temperatures start to rise. Multnomah County Health Officer Dr. Jennifer Vines said in a press release last month that there are a lot of challenges to staying cool, even if it's what our bodies are designed to do. Dr. Vines said, quote, "The human body is extraordinary. It knows what to do to keep our temperature as close to 98.6 as possible, but our systems tire out when they don't get a break. The way to avoid sickness and death during a heat wave is not complicated. It's simply about getting someplace cool and giving your body a break," end quote. The nonprofit Climate Central rates the extreme heat in the Portland metro area as a 2 on their Climate Shift Index, which measures how common a weather event is based on the impact of climate change compared to a world without human-caused climate change. A rating of 2 means that climate change has made the conditions, in this case a heat wave, twice as likely. A wildfire near Yosemite National Park has enveloped 26 square miles, with little progress made to contain it. The Oak Fire spread quickly through bone-dry vegetation and was described as explosive. Over 6,000 residents of the rural foothills of the Sierras have been ordered to evacuate, and at least 10 structures have burned down. The fire started last week while firefighters were working to contain the nearby Washburn Fire, which burned 7 square miles and dangerously close to an old-growth sequoia forest in Yosemite National Park. Pacific Gas and Electric said over the weekend that over 3,000 homes were without power because of the fires, with no indication of when service could return since they couldn't reach the damaged equipment. A glimmer of hope, perhaps, is that the National Weather Service reports a chance of thunderstorms this week. With climate change turning up the heat and more development happening near forests, one expert thinks it's time to bury electrical distribution lines in the West. Roz Brown has more on how burying power lines would help with wildfires and power outages.
Western states under extreme drought made worse by climate change are a giant tinderbox. And one expert says it's time to minimize possible fire sources by burying power lines. Above-ground transmission lines have been mostly an eyesore. But as climate change has worsened the risk and devastation from wildfires, engineering consultant Paul Chinowski says power lines should never be the possible source.
You've got equipment that really wasn't designed to handle the extreme temperatures and environmental conditions we have today.
He says vegetation or heavy winds can cause lines to touch each other and create a spark. Chinowski says the major hurdle is cost, estimated at $4 million or more for each mile of undergrounding. California's Pacific Gas and Electric Utility recently agreed to pay more than $55 million to avoid criminal prosecution for that state's 2021 Dixie wildfire sparked by aging power lines. PG&E also has announced a multi-billion dollar effort to bury 10,000 miles of power lines. Chinowski believes the adversarial relationship that sometimes develops between local governments and their utility company needs to change. He says more cooperation is necessary to ease what would likely be higher rates for customers.
Because this change is going to save homes. It's going to save property. If we don't change it, we're never going to get it done. And we're just going to keep reliving these very destructive wildfires.
Wildfires are now more frequent and intense, and fire seasons last longer. That has led some building homes or structures near or within western forests to use fire-resistant materials. But Chinowski says the new normal is here to stay, and reducing risk is key.
We'll always have some risk. You can't eliminate all risk, and you're not going to eliminate lightning strikes. But if we can eliminate risks that we have control over, it's going to save a lot of people a lot of unhappy times.
New Mexico's recent fire, the largest in the state's history, was not caused by above-ground power lines, but rather ignited by U.S. Forest Service workers using drip torches during a prescribed burn to thin dense woodlands. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Pope Francis delivered an apology to indigenous communities in Canada for the residential school system operated by the church for nearly 150 years. Today, Francis said, quote, "I humbly beg forgiveness for the evil committed by so many Christians against indigenous peoples." He continued, quote, "I'm sorry. I ask forgiveness, in particular for the ways in which many members of the church and of religious communities cooperated, not least through their indifference, in projects of forced assimilation and cultural destruction promoted by the governments of that time, which culminated in the system of residential schools," end quote. Starting in the 1830s, Indigenous children in Canada were taken away from their families and forced into residential schools, where they endured physical, sexual, mental, and emotional abuse. They faced physical punishments for speaking their language, and Christianity was used to break down cultural ties. The Catholic Church operated about two-thirds of the residential schools in Canada. The last residential school shut down in 1998. Over 150,000 Indigenous children spent time in residential schools over its history. Officially, 4,120 children died while in the care of residential schools. The actual number is likely far higher. Last year, an unmarked mass grave of 215 children was discovered on the grounds of the former Kamloops Indian School. Now efforts are underway across Canada and the U.S. to search for more unmarked graves. Indigenous communities have been waiting for recognition of the harm perpetrated by the Catholic Church for some time. Leaders traveled to the Vatican last year to ask the Pope to come to Indigenous land to make an apology. Some residential school survivors and their descendants are unsatisfied with the overtures from the Pope. The Vatican still has possession of school files that could aid in the search families are undertaking to find out what happened to their relatives. The Vatican also has a number of First Nations artifacts, which the church says were gifted to a previous pope. Pope Francis will be spending 6 days in his visit to Canada. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Pope Francis has arrived in Canada at the start of a 6-day official visit. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, he'll meet this week with residential school survivors and is expected to apologize for the Catholic Church's role in the schools.
The Pope arrived late Sunday afternoon in Edmonton, Alberta, where he was welcomed by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Governor General Mary Simon. On hand were other church, Indigenous, and political dignitaries. In a message on his Twitter account, Pope Francis wrote, I hope with God's grace that my penitential pilgrimage might contribute to the journey of reconciliation already undertaken. Please accompany me with prayer." But the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Roseanne Archibald, was not happy that she was not included in the official welcome.
"And we don't feel that it has been about survivors. It has been more about the church, promoting the church's idea, fundraising for the church when they're asking people to pick up their tickets. I mean, this, we have to refocus on what we're really doing here, and that's about survivors accepting or not accepting and listening to that apology from the Pope."
Archibald says she's also disappointed that there were no women in leadership roles for the Edmonton welcome. The Pope is to visit a former Indian residential school south of Edmonton today and is expected to deliver his first public statement in Canada. And he's expected to apologize to Indigenous peoples for the church's role in the abuses they suffered. It's estimated that about 150,000 Native children were forced to attend the residential schools across Canada from the late 1800s to the late 1900s. Thousands were physically, sexually, and emotionally abused. Many died. More than 60% of the schools were run by the Catholic Church. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Menominee Nation has announced a partnership with the Seminole Tribe of Florida to try again to open an off-reservation casino in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM in Milwaukee reports.
The Menominee made the announcement just hours after a village board okayed giving a company linked to the Seminole up to 2 years to buy 60 acres for the casino project. This is the second collaboration for the Menominee and Seminole tribes. 7 years ago, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker blocked a casino plan. But Menominee Chairman Von Korn Sr. says his tribe is still looking for ways to support its members.
"We have a really difficult time meeting the needs of the members of our tribe, and so we've always looked for ways to generate additional revenue to help to meet those needs, and so that's been our goal for a very long time, and it remains our goal yet today."
Korn notes that Walker, a Republican, is no longer Wisconsin governor. Democrat Tony Evers is.
"That would be my, I can't say point of view, maybe, that, you know, be more favorable."
The governor's office is only one of several government entities which would need to okay the casino. So would the city and county of Kenosha and Bureau of Indian Affairs. Evers says he's a long way from making a decision, but he doesn't rule out approval.
"I have approved casinos in the past, so it's not like I'm anti-gambling. In fact, I think the tribal nations of Wisconsin have the right to do that, and I've approved sports gambling and some other things."
But Evers is in a re-election fight against Republicans this year, so the fate of the project may not be known for some time. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Native journalist Tim Gallego passed away Sunday in Rapid City, South Dakota. He was a co-founder of the Native American Journalists Association and started several newspapers. A GoFundMe was recently set up for Gallego, seeking assistance after he had major medical issues. His family posted on social media that he passed away peacefully, surrounded by his daughters and wife. He was 88 years old. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, let's talk about race. Tonight's weather will be balmy and clear with a low of 65 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be up to 101, with that extreme heat warning very much in effect until Thursday evening. Today in history, in 1978, Louise Joy Brown was born, the first human to have been born after being conceived through in vitro fertilization, or IVF. The quote of the day is from American author Jack London, who said, quote, "The proper function of man is to live, not to exist. I shall not waste my days trying to prolong them. I shall use my time." Hearing loss is an issue that many Americans face, but people can protect their ears in loud places with a few tips. Eric Tegadoff has more.
Hearing loss is on the rise, and as people return to the loud places like the gym after pandemic-induced hiatuses, medical professionals are advising them to protect their hearing. Alice Schott, an audiologist with Oregon Health and Science University, says people have a tendency to turn up their headphones to drown out a noisy place like the gym. She says there are headphone options that can help people navigate this predicament.
You can just get good, totally covering the ear, we call them circumoral headphones, with noise canceling features. So that allows you to reduce your background noise and then to keep what you're listening to in your ears instead of leaking back out.
Schott says anything above 85 decibels is considered the top end of the listening levels. Many headphones on the market can reach well above that, but there are phone apps that can help people monitor the levels on their headphones. Schott says hearing loss is on the rise among young people, and it's connected to the devices used to listen to music. Claire Johnson, an audiologist with United Healthcare, says people should follow the 60-60 rule. That means limiting music for 60 minutes at a time at 60% of the music player's volume. She also says that folks' diets can help their hearing, such as post-workout snacks high in potassium, zinc, and magnesium.
Foods like bananas, spinach, and yogurt can provide nutrients that are going to help maintain your hearing health. It's something we don't often think about, but our inner ear is actually a really delicate organ that needs nourishing fuel as well.
Schott says people of every age, from infancy to old age, should have their hearing protected in some way.
Hearing protection is always an option. They have great over-the-counter options. And then if that doesn't fit you well, there's always custom. So there's an option out there. You just have to kind of explore what they are.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
The White House says President Biden is feeling fine as he's battling COVID. With that story and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
All of his vitals have always been in the normal range.
White House COVID-19 response coordinator Ashish Jha says President Joe Biden is feeling fine as he battles COVID-19 and an upper respiratory infection. The president tested positive on Thursday, but felt well enough to attend a Friday virtual meeting with economic advisors.
Let me start by apologizing my voice. I'm feeling much better than I sound.
At 79, Biden is at severe risk of illness from COVID, but is vaccinated and double boosted. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says the president is being administered of the antiviral Paxlovid and following CDC guidance to isolate and test.
And if your test remains positive, you would consider staying home until that test is negative, which is exactly what the president is doing.
LGBTQ organizations are calling on the administration to expand testing and vaccine access for monkeypox, which has been declared a global health emergency. 44 states have reported cases, including two in children. Former Vice President Al Gore is applauding Biden's commitment to solving the climate crisis, but says a broken democracy is hindering real change. He likened those who ignore climate science to the police who failed to act during the deadly shooting in Uvalde, Texas.
Confronted with this global emergency, what we're doing with our inaction and failing to walk through the door and stop the killing is not typical of what we are capable of.
Gore argued for ending the filibuster in the Senate so climate legislation can pass. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris says the 50-50 split in the Senate is hampering efforts to codify abortion rights now that a bill to do that has passed the House.
We need to elect two more senators so that we can get the United States Congress, now the House has acted, on the Senate side to act to protect a woman's right to choose. That's what we need. And thankfully, President Biden has said he will not let the filibuster get in the way.
Harris is meeting with Indiana lawmakers today as that state considers a bill that would ban abortion with limited exceptions. Four members of the January 6th House Committee, including the two Republicans, are pushing for a criminal investigation of former President Donald Trump. Wyoming Republican and committee chair Liz Cheney told CNN that Trump is not fit to be president. But speaking at a supporter event on Saturday, Trump again teased a 2024 run.
If I announced that I was not going to run for office, the persecution of Donald Trump would immediately stop. But that's what they want me to do. And you know what? There's no chance I do that.
A New York man is facing a federal assault charge for attempting to stab U.S. Congressman Lee Zeldin at a campaign event last week. 43-year-old David Jack Ubonis was arrested Saturday, just hours after being released on a state charge. Investigators have ruled out a political motive and say Jack Ubonis did not know who Zeldin was. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Supreme Court will hear a case that originated in Idaho about what types of bodies of water are covered under the Clean Water Act. Eric Tegedoff has a story.
This fall, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a challenge to the Clean Water Act that could upend what bodies of water are protected from pollution. The case, Sackett versus U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, began in Idaho, where the Sacketts are challenging the Clean Water Act's protections of wetlands they say are on their property. Albert Lin is a law professor at the University of California, Davis, who specializes in environmental and natural resources law. He says the Supreme Court will decide on the extent of the Clean Water Act's power.
Here, the authority over wetlands is something that's clearly in the statute, and the question is, well, how far does that authority go?
Nearly 50 waterkeeper groups have filed a Friend of the Court brief in support of the EPA, including the Boise-based Snake River Waterkeeper. Buck Ryan, executive director of the organization, says Idaho has unique geographical and hydrologic features that form closed basins that could be excluded if the definition of waters of the U.S. is reduced. In June, the Supreme Court ruled that the EPA did not have the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate emissions from power plants, with the majority arguing under the new major questions doctrine that Congress must approve powers of this scope. However, Lin says EPA has grappled with its regulatory authority over wetlands under the Clean Water Act for decades, making the two cases different.
It's not the sort of situation as in West Virginia versus EPA, where you had, at least the way the court puts it, EPA asserting this apparently new authority over how energy is produced and distributed and generated.
The Clean Water Act was enacted in 1972 to protect the health of the waters of the U.S., promote healthy aquatic ecosystems, and regulate the discharge of pollutants into waterways. Clean water advocates are asking the Supreme Court to uphold the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling about the scope of wetlands protected under the landmark Clean Water Act. For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A lush garden in Utah makes the most of a small amount of rain. The garden at the University of Utah in Moab gets only 9.5 inches of rain annually. Dr. Anthony Leiswitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and this is Climate Connections. On the University of Utah campus in Moab, grasses and pollinator plants grow beneath apple and cherry trees. It's a lush garden in a place that only gets about 9.5 inches of rain a year. But it does not require heavy irrigation.
I can say that over the last 3 years in Moab, we have watered our gardens, the permaculture gardens on campus, less than 10 times.
That's Rosalind McCann, the university's Sustainable Communities Extension Specialist. She says the garden was designed to make the most of rainwater when it does fall. Water is channeled into the garden from rooftops and parking lots through gutters and curb cuts. It soaks into a layer of mulch that retains moisture and allows it to seep slowly into the soil. Some rain is also collected in cisterns for watering during dry spells. The region is getting even drier as the climate warms, so McCann says it will be increasingly important to design landscapes with water conservation and reuse in mind.
The fact that we're getting cherries and apples and plums, currants, all sorts of amazing edibles in an area primarily rainwater fed with only 9.5 inches, that's climate resilience right there.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
There will be an estimated 150,000 new cases of colon and rectal cancer in 2022. But doctors fear some people will go unscreened because of the ongoing pandemic. We go again to Eric Tegedoff for more.
Cancer screenings are important tools for health professionals, but some worry the pandemic could dampen numbers. In particular, screenings for colorectal cancers are key for people starting at age 45, or younger for people with a family history of these cancers. Dr. Maggie Chin is a family physician with Kaiser Permanente in Linwood.
Early detection is really key to treatment of colon cancer. So there's a big urgency to get people started again on regular screenings so that we can avoid a future pandemic-related uptick in cancer diagnosis.
There will be 150,000 new cases of colon and rectal cancer in 2022, according to estimates from the American Cancer Society. It also is among the most commonly diagnosed cancers in the United States. one screening tool for colorectal cancers is a colonoscopy. However, Chin says it can be invasive and time-consuming. Another less invasive option is a test known as a fecal immunochemical test, or FIT test, which can be done at home. Chin says with the FIT test, medical professionals examine a person's stool for microscopic amounts of blood.
This is a really unique test in that it can be completed in the privacy of your own home and bathroom. It doesn't require a medical visit or any sedation or any colon preparation, and definitely doesn't require you to take any time off of work.
Chin says the FIT test is as reliable as a colonoscopy for average risk patients, but has to be done every year. About 9 in 10 people whose colorectal cancers are found early and treated are still alive 5 years later, according to the CDC. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 25th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Roz Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.